When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. It is Easter, so happy Easter, everybody. I hope the bunnies are all hopping through your gorgeous green lawn now that it is green, now that it's spring, and finally winter is over. I thought that we would celebrate today because it's Earth Day. Well, it's not Earth Day today, but it will be on Tuesday, and the 22nd is yet another celebration of the fact that the world is getting a little crazy as it comes to weather. But in any case, Earth Day is an important milestone, and I've invited four special guests on the show today to talk about different parts of the world and things that they're seeing, all of it relating to green building. So the first guest that we have is Sherry Coons. She is the author of four books in this amazing series, the latest of which is called Prefabulous World, Energy Efficient and Sustainable Homes Around the Globe. Sherry, you've been a guest with us before, so welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I know that your favorite thing is probably that Robert Redford wrote the foreword to this, and it's a very good foreword, I have to say. So congratulations on nailing
Thank
him
you.
For that. But what I love about these books, which first of all are gloriously photographed, they are coffee table worthy of whatever coffee table you're going to put out, is that you've taken the time to look at green building techniques and how they can just be so beautiful as to really make you want to live there. And it almost seems to me in these books, as I flip through the pages, that the prefabulous world, right, homes that are prefabricated elsewhere, people have in mind something so ugly and awful, right? You tend to think about, you know, almost like tin cans of a home, and yet the homes that you have in all of your books, and particularly this one, are just beautiful, beautiful homes. It's hard to imagine they were actually built not on site in a factory somewhere. So maybe we talk about this for a moment, how you got the idea to look at a sustainable model, which is prefabrication of homes, and bring out the architectural and real beauty in them.
Right. Well, people are not going to be interested in building really green or energy efficient houses unless they're really attractive. So when I choose the houses for my books, I'm always looking for interesting and attractive houses so that it's the whole package, not just the energy efficiency. And I think I still talk to people about prefab and they still think I'm talking about trailer. And
right, manufactured housing. I mean, it doesn't sound pretty at all. The word is really ugly.
Right, but it's interesting to me because I've been writing about this for so long and I've spoken about it at conferences, and to me it is so much a part of our world today that prefab is the future of home building, and I'm still surprised that people think that there's a difference. And I think that most people pass houses today that are prefabricated, and since they're indistinguishable from site-built houses, they wouldn't even know that they were prefab.
Oh, if you look at these houses with their incredible views, some of them, and the one on your cover is just spectacular, there's no way that you would know that this is anything other than a custom-built, highly designed, fantastic house. That's what you would think as you look through these pages, that every house is more beautiful than the next. I like to think about your books as being almost like when people call me up and they say, I want to renovate my kitchen or I want to build a house, what's the first thing I should do? And I always say you should go find pictures of really beautiful houses that speak to you and cut them out of the magazines and put them in a file folder, and this is going to become your inspiration, or do it on Pinterest. But your houses in these books, the ones that you find, are so inspirational, not just on a green level, but for anybody who's interested in great design and great architecture.
Thank you. That's true. And I think that what I try to do is put a lot of sidebars with information about different technologies and materials that people can incorporate into a site-built house if that's what they choose to do. But they can also learn a lot about energy efficiency and sustainability from reading the book. So it's not purely about prefab. And I think the houses in here are just great examples of attractive architecture and interesting architecture, in addition to being educational about some of these other aspects.
So the book is called, just for everybody tuning in now, Prefabulous World, Energy Efficient and Sustainable Homes Around the Globe. Sherry Kunz is the author. You can find the books, all of her books. This is the fourth in the series, and Amazon. What is your favorite house in the book, and how did you find it?
Well, that's like asking somebody who's their favorite.
I have a favorite.
Child?
Okay, I have a favorite child. I'm just not saying who it is today. It's either Alex or Michael, and it depends on the day. So today, for today, 2 days before Earth Day, what's your favorite house in the book?
One of my favorite houses in the book is a house that was built in the Netherlands, where they took a tree that was being removed by the municipality, and they cut it down and used it down the center of the house to hold up a balcony. And it is such a natural, beautiful interior right in the center of Amsterdam. And they incorporated every type of sustainable material and energy efficiency, from solar panels to wind turbines. And they used a new material called aerogel, which was developed by NASA as an insulation. So it just really was intriguing to me that somebody would incorporate so much of this into one house. And I loved the pictures, and it was just a very interesting house. But I also liked the other 49 houses, and they were all ones that I handpicked from lots of options.
How did you find them? How do you find these houses? Do architects now know you and they send you submissions? Do you send out a submission request? What happens?
All of the above. I do know a lot of architects, and I'm associated with a lot of the people in the structural insulated panel and modular industry and panelized, so I know them. I also do a lot of research on the internet, and I look for passive houses, which I think are so up and coming in this country as well as around the world, that's a certification process which is only focused on energy as opposed to LEED, which incorporates a lot of other aspects. So I've looked for passive house. I've worked with the organizations around the country, both LEED and passive house, to find houses. And it took me almost 2 years to collect all of these houses because I am so fussy. I don't want to have a house that is not sustainable and energy efficient or that is not attractive. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot of all of those components to have me incorporate it.
When you think about where this country is going with its building practices and how you've got these kinds of competing standards, and really a lot of this energy efficiency stuff, when you build it, maybe is a third more expensive or a quarter more expensive. Maybe it's not more expensive at all, but it requires specialists. From a consumer point of view, the savings isn't there usually immediately. And I know that's been part of the hesitation, even with changing over to CFLs. Mm-hmm. What have you learned about that and about the cost savings and the expenditures as you've been doing these different books?
The trend is for houses to get more and more energy efficient, and the architects and builders are really learning a lot over the years. Some of them are still wanting to do what they did, 10 years ago and 5 years ago, but a lot of the builders are getting on board to build more energy efficiency. And even if it costs a little bit more, which in some cases it doesn't, you are going to save for the life of the house, both in using sustainable materials and also building the house in a more energy efficient way. So there's no doubt that you're going to save money in the long run by building more energy efficiency. And the other thing that I'm finding really interesting is I've been kind of following the how Tesla is doing in the car market.
Tesla, uh-huh.
And I think that the future, I think if we all look into the future in 5 years, a lot more people are going to be having electric cars, and they're going to be powered by the house. So we can now put solar panels and PV panels on the roof that can run our houses and also can create enough energy for our cars. And I really think that's where it's going, because energy is just getting so expensive, and to run our cars is so expensive, to run our houses is so expensive, and this is really a win-win for homeowners to be able to live their life this way. And I'm beginning to see it, and I think it is the future.
I got to tell you, I wish when we rebuilt our house was an addition and an expansion onto a very old house from the 1880s. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I wish that we had put in a geothermal pump and heated up the driveway. Man, especially this winter with the 90 sure. inches of snow we've had.
Yeah.
Sherry, in the different books that you've done, one of them is Prefabulous and Sustainable, and it's all about building and customizing an affordable, energy-efficient home. Then you've got Prefabulous Ways to Get the Home of Your Dreams, and Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid,
right.
and it's about building energy efficiency. You know, how far from the very I can't remember when this first book came out. I'm going to say like 8 years ago?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So in the 8 years, have you seen it just the biggest change that you have seen in the way they're building? Is it the know-how or a use of a technology? What have you seen? What's the one thing?
I think that the builders and architects have discovered how to make houses more and more efficient. When I did Prefabulous and Sustainable, I thought I was finding the most energy efficient houses around the country. And as by the time that book was complete and was coming out, I started getting information on houses that were even more efficient. And that's why I did the next book, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid, because the houses that I found there were a lot of houses that didn't even have solar power that or PV panels or even geothermal, and they were built so efficiently that they didn't even require a lot of energy.
Yeah, it's the high R factor for sure.
Right. So I've been seeing, as I've been going along, I've been seeing more and more efficiency in these houses. And when I went to look at houses around the world, I was just so surprised to see some of the technologies that were being used in other countries. And again, a lot of the houses did not have power sources like solar or geothermal, but they were built so excellent that they didn't even need it. And I think that's the future. It's really wonderful to have solar panels and PV panels, but I think it's the most important thing is to build a house that is efficient in itself before anything.
Sherry Coons is my guest this morning. She is the author of the fourth in the series, Prefabulous World, Energy Efficient and Sustainable Homes Around the Globe. Sherry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Sherry Coons, Prefabulous World, Energy Efficient and Sustainable Homes Around the Globe, is available at Amazon.com. It just came out. And again, if you are renovating your house and thinking about putting in some energy efficient stuff, or if you're going to be building, or if you just want to look at some gorgeous pictures, this is a great book. It's the fourth in a series, and I've known Sherry for a long time. This is just an amazing piece of work that she's added to just the other three books. So you can find it on Amazon. Mickey Cook is going to be by. She's the author and a green building and sustainability consultant, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this idea of building green and what you can do, even if your house is already built, to save yourself some money, always a good thing, and, of course, make the world a little bit of a greener place, all in honor of Earth Day, which is Tuesday, and happy Easter while we're at it. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on WSB.
every Sunday. Elise Link is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back everybody to the Elise Link Show. Live on Sundays on WSB, Rebuilding America. One greenhouse at a time. And that's what we're doing today. We're talking about green building and how it can be sustainable both for the earth and for your pocketbook. And in fact, my next guest, Mickey Cook, is a green building and sustainability consultant who bemoans the idea that green building has become so deeply associated with high cost. And in her new book, Green Home Building, Money-Saving Strategies for an Affordable, Healthy, High-Performance Home, she has some tips and suggestions for making it a little less expensive. Mickey, welcome to the Elise Link Show.
Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So tell me a little bit about how you and Doug Garrett, who's a building science consultant and you're an environmental consultant, a green building consultant.
Yes.
How you guys have worked together to come up with this book.
Well, actually, the book was kind of a result of experiences that I've had as a green building consultant, where I've seen most builders approach green building as an add-on item to homes they were already building, so just adding more expensive materials and systems, high-performance systems, and adding cost to projects. And as is typical with anybody building a home, everybody's got a budget, and when you reach your budget limit, you stop adding things. And usually the first things that get cut are the green building features that you added. So I saw this reoccurring theme of people running out of money, abandoning their green building goals, and not ever achieving the performance that they wanted from the homes or the benefits that they wanted. So I saw that the problem was that green building is treated as an add-on in most cases. And so I thought, you know, there's a better approach. There's an approach where there are builders that use this approach, where you actually start from the very beginning and you look at the project holistically, and you plan and you design and you build the home using money-saving strategies so that you save money in your base construction cost and leave funds available for those high-performance upgrades.
So give me an example of that, because I think it's hard for people to imagine. I mean, a house costs what a house costs in a lot of cases.
Well, and a house costs what it costs because of how it is designed and built. And so one of the best examples I have is the shape of a house. Every time you have a projection off of a basic rectangular shape, it adds cost to foundations, to the structural components that are needed to support the roof, to the roof structure itself, all the interior finish materials. It adds cost to every aspect of the house. So the simpler you can keep the design, the simpler you can build that base building affordably. And then you have money left in your budget to add high-performance materials and systems and actually achieve what you wanted from the total of the home rather than just from, you know, adding on what you could afford to add on.
But I think that nobody would want to see just a neighborhood of basically boxes where there's nothing interesting architecturally, and they all look exactly the same in order to be energy efficient. So there has to be a balance to that.
Right, and we are not promoting boxes by any means. There are many ways to add architectural details to homes without complicating the structure. There's actually a formula that we discuss in the book. It's called the shape factor, and it's a formula that can be used that will allow some deviations in a rectangular design, but over a certain degree, you start acting costs. And so that's what we're promoting, is that you use these strategies that are discussed for money savings and apply those savings to the high performance features that you want.
So one of the things that the green home building, that green home building looks at, is this idea that how do you get to net zero energy? So zeroing out on waste, water, carbon. People talk about being carbon neutral.
Right.
What do you, you know, that seems so, even today, a little far-fetched, except for people who have just the most amount of money to spend. What do you think when it comes down to it? How do you advise people?
Well, it's really interesting because when I first wrote the book was 11 chapters, and the first 10 are called 10 Steps to an Affordable Green Home. And the 11th chapter was called Getting to Net Zero, and it was a net zero energy model for a home that's very achievable. I mean, it's just there's no reason that anyone could not achieve net zero on an affordable green home using this model. And then it dawned on me that there are these other zero components. People are more and more interested in zero water because of all the drought situations that we're having across the country and water resource issues. People are also interested in zero waste. And many cities now have initiatives to drive toward zero waste and zero carbon. You know, more and more people are looking at their carbon footprint. So I thought that we should also address those, that a good green building book should also address how achievable is this for the average person. So what we do in the last five chapters of the book called Getting to Zero is relook at how we built the home in the first 10 chapters and how those methods contribute to getting to zero on all of these fronts. And you find out that it's fairly easy to do this. Very last chapter is called Zero Cost, and it's how to build a green home for basically the same cost as a traditionally built home, and we give case study and a model for doing that.
What about people who are renovating, who aren't going to build from the ground up? Because a lot of these strategies in the book, I think, do deal with when you're still on the plans, when you're looking at blueprints, and it takes an architect who really knows what they're doing, which is another added expense, as opposed to a lot of people still are buying plans off the internet and then just kind of remodeling them a little bit. So where do you kind of, you know, if somebody's remodeling, how do you do that?
Yeah, there's actually not that much difference in remodeling and new construction other than location. I mean, if you're remodeling, you certainly can't move to a better location that might be a more affordable aspect to your total household budget. But, you know, as far as remodeling goes, most of the remodeling projects that we see do involve an architect. And so they are, you know, basically taking the house down to studs. They're redesigning or adding on to the structure. So those are the same strategies that you would use if you were building a new home. It's just looking at it holistically and making sure that, again, you're not doing such an outrageous design that you're adding unnecessary costs and spending all your available funds on the structure itself, and not leaving yourself any cushion to pay for these green features that you want.
What do you think is the amount of money that people will save as they're doing this? Or is the idea that you're not going to pay less for your house with the green features, you're just not going to pay more?
Well, we have an entire chapter of the book that is dedicated to, because the book presents itself as being able to build a truly green home regardless of what your budget is. And that's a pretty broad commitment, because you will have people that are on very limited budgets. And we do present a strategy for achieving a truly green home. I don't care how limited your budget is. And then if you do have more of a mainstream budget, we tell you how to invest the savings that you saved in your base construction, where to invest it to get the best return on those investments. And then people that have, you know, more money to build a custom home, where we would advise them to spend that money. So we really do believe that you can build a good green home regardless of what your budget is, but the cost savings really come from using this approach of starting from the planning phase, the design phase, the construction phase, to attention to details to make sure that you are not wasting money in your basic construction costs so that you have money left.
What is the number one tip that you recommend that will help people save money when they're
building? Design is everything. having someone that understands, once you read the book and you know what the strategies are, making sure that this person that you are working with to design your project understands that these are your goals. They understand the strategies that need to be used to achieve those goals, and they understand that this is how you're funding the green features of your home. The case studies that we give in the book, I think the two case studies each show achieving these high-performance green homes for just a couple of $1,000s more than a traditional home. So the operational and maintenance cost savings alone will pay that back in just a couple of years. Even in the sample budget that we include at the end of the book, we say that you can really do the most custom features in a home and be able to expect a no longer than a 15-year payback. So, you know, 15 years is pretty quick, and after that, then you're banking savings over what...
Gosh knows, I don't even know where the last 15 years has gone since I've been hosting this show,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, after 15 years, you're just banking all those savings because mm-hmm. You've paid off those investments. It's really a tremendous long-term savings potential.
Well, thanks, Mickey, for explaining that. Mickey Cook is the author of Green Home Building, Money-Saving Strategies for an Affordable, Healthy, High-Performance House. It is going to be out in paperback in September of this year, and you can pre-order it right now on Amazon. Mickey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Elise.
I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, a greenhouse, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Link is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Link Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. You know, it's funny. I mentioned earlier when I was talking to Mickey that when we were building our house, I wished we had put in a geothermal system, which I'd actually seen on one of those PBS home shows like 20 years ago. And the guy was in Minnesota, and I thought, wow, that would be great, never to shovel snow again. And then, of course, you look at it and you think, that's like a lot of money just to never shovel snow. And this came up again with my neighbors who are renovating their house, and they've actually, it's completely not green, but it is really beautiful. And I said to them, why didn't you put, money's no object for them, and I said, why didn't you put in some sort of snow melting thing for your driveway? And she said, you know, it probably would have cost us $100,000 to put one of those geothermal pumps in. She said, you know what, I like shoveling my own snow, and I wasn't really willing to spend $100,000. Because when you think about it, even if you get charged $100 a load to move the snow, that's a lot of years before that kind of thing pays off. And so Mickey's book does have some strategies for that, but you have to always think about cost, even when you're building green. I just think cost is really important. All right, stay tuned. We've got a whole other hour. We're celebrating Earth Day today. Happy Easter, everybody. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. It's Easter Sunday, so happy Easter to all of you. It's also 2 days before Earth Day. Earth Day this year, April 22nd, it's on Tuesday. If you're listening Monday morning early, it's tomorrow. And I thought it would be really important as we're watching the green movement just gathering such incredible strength. It's just going from strength to strength. Our kids seem to be much more aware of what's going on with green and environmentalism than we were a generation ago. And so I thought for Earth Day this year, we'd celebrate by having some guests come on the show and give a perspective on what's going on, what they see going on, and how you can actually bring green building into your own lives, into your homes, the homes you're building, the homes you're remodeling. So all of everybody's information is going to be up on the thinklink.com blog, so you'll be able to go there, but and we'll be tweeting out information, but you can also find copies of their books online at Amazon as well. My next guest is Carl Seville. He's an author and a green building consultant, and he's from Decatur, Georgia, so he's local. And he started a company called SK Collaborative, and you can find them online at skcollaborative.com. Carl, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about your vision of green, where we're going and what you've seen going on in your 25-year career.
Sure. Well, green building has been evolving sort of slowly and steadily. It's had a few hiccups here and there. But it's really kind of taken hold in the marketplace. Different regions are sort of more into it than others. And we have sort of a mid-level interest here in the Atlanta area. Multifamily buildings, there's a lot of green certified buildings. Pretty much all the apartments you see going up are certified as LEED or Earthcraft or Energy Star. Single-family homes, people were very interested in it for a while, but it sort of fell off a little bit with the downturn in the economy. We're starting to see it come back, which is very exciting.
So when you say that you're seeing it come back, I still find that green building techniques tend to be much more expensive than regular techniques. And we're also not building that many houses right now. We're not doing as much remodeling. In fact, I often say on the show that new home building is still in kind of a depression state. But where do you see it taking hold? And is it really the whole house under, say, a LEED model or an energy? Is it more, okay, I'm going to buy Energy Star appliances?
Well, I actually think that new home building is moving pretty strongly again. It's really picked up a lot in certainly different markets. Very much in town and some communities, there's a fair amount of building going on, and remodeling is also picked up. But in terms of green building and single family homes, what I think we've seen is a lot of techniques that were kind of cutting edge a few years ago, spray foam insulation, high efficiency equipment, things of that sort, good high quality lighting, high efficiency lighting, has really become pretty mainstream. So there are people using some green techniques and products in a lot of projects right now. What we're not seeing a lot of in the single family market is sort of truly green from the start buildings, unfortunately. I'd like to see more of that going on.
And
one other point I want to make, you said that green is expensive, and I think that really is a bit of a fallacy. One of the reasons that a green building does tend to cost more right now is because we're struggling against a marketplace where most constructions are pretty poor quality. Builders are generally not meeting energy codes, they're not enforced very well, they're not installing things per the manufacturer's recommended instructions, and people really aren't thinking green from the start in their building. Whereas if we were to just plan well from the beginning to make buildings green and follow all the rules, pretty much any building could be green at little or no additional cost.
So give me an example of how that's true, because if people are just building bad buildings, most people don't realize that they're building or buying a badly built building until they've already moved in. And so then it's a little bit late. And inspectors, I find, vary in quality, as I'm sure you have in your career. And so isn't it a lot to ask a person who's buying a new home, who may be buying it not off the plans but are walking into a new home, isn't it a little much to be asking them to be policing this stuff and saying, well, start from the beginning and building green? I mean, isn't that a little counterintuitive?
Well, it's not easy, for certain. Because people don't really, we don't have the quality control in the industry, and we don't have the ability to sort of check out our buildings like we do our cars and our stereos and phones and things like that, because they're pretty much all one-off products. Even production builders are building one-off products. But, I inspect a lot of homes for energy code compliance, and as well as green certification, and it's so inconsistent that people are not doing proper insulation, proper air sealing, proper HVAC insulation. And the inspectors don't really enforce the codes very much. It's really kind of a shame. We actually have a very good energy code in Georgia. It's just not consistently enforced.
Right. So, again, I go back to sort of a homeowner. How do homeowners get help? How are they supposed to know when something's not built right?
Well,
even if you get a home inspector, they may not realize it.
Well, if somebody's trying to buy an existing home, if it's if it's a brand new home, what I would aim for is look for somebody that's certifying their house as Earthcraft, Energy Star, the National Green Building Standard, any one of these green building certifications, and make sure it's actually certified to that as opposed to just built to the standards. A lot of people say it builds to green standards, but they don't get them certified. One of the benefits of getting buildings certified is there's a third-party independent person like myself who comes in and checks the work and tests the house at the end to make sure it actually does meet the program criteria.
But a typical house that's not advertised that way, there'd be no point in getting a certification for it because it won't pass.
Right. You can't do it afterwards. What I'm saying is, but if we can start creating some demand for certified homes, it will be there. The next step is if you're buying an existing home, it could be a new home, it could be a used home, you could have a home energy audit before you complete the purchase. Do that as in addition to a standard inspection. And a home auditor can come in and inspect the heating and air conditioning system, look for moisture problems, inspect insulation, inspect air sealing. And, you know, it would probably be a good idea to do that in a new home because they can point out things that the builder missed. And you can go back in and ask them to do it. Or in an existing home, they can point out things that were not done properly the first time or have degraded over time that need improvement.
So I love energy audits, and I've had one done in my own house, which was built in the 1880s. And then we renovated about 15 years ago. And it's interesting because my husband Sam and I, are very, very careful about, as you might expect from the show, about what we spend and how we've saved money over the years. And so the auditor came in, and he's like, oh, okay, you've got caulk around the windows. That's great. Oh, you've got a door flap at the bottom. That's great. Sort of basic stuff that, you know, really over time has added up. And, you know, at the end of the day, he walked around with a candle. I think people don't even realize what they do. So a lot of times they set up a inner house fan and then they measure how the volume of air passes through, or they walk around the windows and they hold a candle up to see if it flickers so that you've got any air that's leaking through. Sometimes they do a smoke test where they put up, no, they don't change smoke in your house. They blow smoke, and so you see where the air can actually be moving.
Right.
And I think that all of those things are really helpful. And so if you spend $300-$400 on an energy audit, that can actually find some places that you can save money.
Well, the other thing is, in addition to saving money, there are two key components. In addition to saving money, one is comfort. You get a house that is well-insulated and well-air-sealed and has an effective heating and air conditioning system, and it's significantly more comfortable. Very few hot and cold spots, much better humidity control, really high indoor air quality, less dust, and that also leads to healthier indoor air, where people, I've literally had clients that have renovated their house and their allergies go away. They stop buying tissues and clean less. So, you know, we have to think this isn't just energy, this isn't just money. It's health and comfort, which, frankly, people are often willing to spend more money for. You know, if you were going to go buy a house, and I could guarantee you, in addition to being less expensive to run, it would be more comfortable and healthier, you'd probably buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what you guarantee.
Yeah, well, that's what can be guaranteed
right.
In a high-performing home.
Right. And I think what's interesting is we've kind of come back from the place where, and this was about 10 or 15 years ago, where new houses were being built completely sealed. It was like the air was stale in the house. There was no, you need some fresh air coming through the house to suck it out and to renew
right.
it. And we went back from that.
Well, we didn't actually go back from that. What we did was we recognized that we needed to add ventilation into houses. So, you know, everybody says, oh, a house should be breezed, we need to let it be a certain amount of leakiness. But we really should build houses as tight as we're capable of, and then intentionally ventilate them through fans, energy recovery ventilators, or, frankly, just opening the windows parts of the year when it's done. So under no circumstances should we allow a house to be leaky through various cracks. You want to control where the air is coming in.
Sounds good. Carl Seville is an author and green building consultant, and you've also written a textbook, right, on residential green building and renovation? Is that right?
Yes, the first college textbook on the subject.
Wow, which is terrific, and we've come certainly a long way from there. You can find out more about Carl at his website, skcollaborative.com. He's based in Decatur, Georgia. Carl, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Elise Link. Stay tuned.
Every Sunday, Elise Link is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Link Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. We're putting up everybody's information from today's show at the thinklink.com blog, so you can go there, check out today's blog post. Even, yes, on Easter Sunday, we'll have something up, and we'll be sending out some tweets with everybody's information. If you're interested in any of our guests, following up with them, their books, if you've got more questions, you can find out all the information at thinklink.com. And then the show will be uploaded to the site probably a little bit late this week, maybe Wednesday or Thursday, but be sure to tune in. Our next guest, I swear this is really true. His name is Marcus de la Fleur, and he is a sustainable landscape architect. It's just like those meteorologists named Winter or Freeze. There's someone named Amy Freeze, and she was a meteorologist. I thought that was pretty cool. Well, anyway, Marcus is going to come on the show and talk about sustainable landscapes and how to treat water in a landscape. You know, in Atlanta, over the 15 years or so that I've been hanging out here at WSB, we've gone through periods of drought. We've gone through periods where there's just way more water than we know what to do with. And in the end, it's really about building a landscape that's beautiful. Everybody wants green grass and wonderful flowering trees. And yet, that's just not always sustainable. It doesn't have to be like arid, like Arizona or New Mexico, but we have to figure out a way to use less water so that when we need water, it's there for us. So I'm hoping that our next guest is going to be able to talk about that. So stay tuned. Marcus de la Fleur, a sustainable landscape architect, is up next. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to The Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to The Elise Glink Show. It's Easter Sunday, and it's 2 days before we have Earth Day on the 22nd, which is Tuesday. And so I thought what we'd do is continue our conversation about building green and sustainable design. And this all needs to move now right into the garden. And so the whole idea of, we were talking about this just before the break, having water when you need it. Water is, I think, the thing that the next war will be probably fought over. It is definitely draining away. We've had years here in Atlanta where we've been in drought. We've had years where there's just way too much water, and the unpredictable nature of weather these days means that we're going to have a lot more drought and a lot more rain than we know what to do with, just not maybe when we both need it. Marcus de la Fleur is a sustainable landscape architect. You can find him at De La Fleur, D-E-L-A-F-L-E-U-R, for those of you who are familiar with French, .com, or on Twitter, M de la Fleur. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So when you look at, I know you're based in Chicago, which is my hometown. We're here in Atlanta, and yet the water issue is really big, whether you're north, south, east, or west these days. Everybody seems to be having either too much water or not nearly enough water. What are you seeing?
You're absolutely right, and you mentioned Atlanta, and I remember in the news, I think it was around 2007, where your audience had a terrible, terrible drought. And I also recall that it was either a couple of years before or after where everybody basically got washed out. And it seems like these days, you know, you either have the one extreme where you have nothing, or you have the other extreme where you have too much, but very little is left in between where we can enjoy normal conditions, quote-unquote.
So when you're looking at sustainable design for a landscape, what are the things that you evaluate? Because I think a lot of our listeners, everybody loves their green lawns, but, you know, we're getting to a place where we maybe not be able to afford it. Maybe monetarily we can afford it, but sustainability-wise we may not be able to afford it. So what's the first thing you think about when evaluating landscape like that?
With a sustainable landscape, it often really starts with the water in the landscape. And it's a really interesting subject because water in a landscape is, if you look around, it's really fundamentally misunderstood. What happened from a historic perspective is that most of the rainwater that fell out of the sky actually infiltrated into the ground, into our geology. And then it started to move at different time scales through the geology in terms of hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, you name it. And that water movement we call base flow.
And that base flow started to feed into our fens, spring, rivers, streams, creeks, wetlands. All those were fed by that base flow. What happens in our contemporary landscape is that infiltrating into geology really has become unfashionable. If you look at how we develop, we put a lot of materials and surfaces on our properties that are impervious. Your roof, your driveway, you name it. Even your lawn. Your lawn is actually not absorbing much rainwater at all. If you have a small storm, it will absorb that rainwater. But as soon as you have a big storm, that turf grass gets overwhelmed very quickly, and basically it sheds water off too, like your pavement does or like your roof does.
That's interesting. I hadn't actually thought about your lawn not being an absorbing factor.
It is an absorbing factor, but it's a very small one. So, you know, what we are usually concerned about is the big storms where everything floods, and in those big storms, the turf grass won't save your skin.
So what do you do when you are planning for something that could be drought one year or a huge flood the next, you know, maybe even week to week, which is a huge amount of stress on a landscape? But how do you build a landscape back that will absorb that much water and yet be drought resistant?
You can start with the landscape selection, with the plant selection. You can take a very rigid approach and basically decide that whatever can't sustain itself for the season doesn't belong on the landscape. If you don't want to have much maintenance to do, you don't want to water all the time, you just pick the plants that are acclimatized to your particular locale, to your particular ecosystem and climate, and they will do without irrigation, even in through periods of drought. But in the bigger picture, we are sort of, or what I'm trying to do, or what I recommend to my clients, is to reverse that cycle of shedding the water off the landscape of your property. But rather than shedding it, treat it as a precious resource, try to keep it. And there are number of ways on how you can do that. Rainwater harvesting, for instance, you can have rain barrels or cisterns in which you can collect that water when it rains, and then use it when you don't have the rain but need the water. And then there are infiltration techniques where you collect that water at grade in what we call rain gardens or bioswales, collect the water in these rain gardens and bioswales, and then let it slowly or allow it slowly to infiltrate back into the ground. So you basically start feeding the water back into the geology, into the base flow.
Where do you, around, I know you've traveled quite a bit and you've seen a lot of different things. Where do you see this being done the best, this collection? Is it in places of drought more than places where there's just too much water, where people feel like every single drop is precious, and that's where they really put the effort and the energy into the water collection? I was just in Mexico, and, you know, everybody there has a cistern. Water, rainwater is collected, it's treated, sometimes it's used for the garden, a lot of times it becomes the water of the house that people shower in and bathe in or even drink. But where do you find that these kinds of water collection techniques are being used the most in the U.S.?
I think the more sparse the resources are, the more you find the solution to the sparseness. Like you said, if you don't have a lot of rain, when it rains, you're really interested in collecting it and holding it onto it rather than letting it go. If you live in a rather densely developed urban environment where every time it rains you get a lot of flooding, suddenly people get very, very interested in, you know, doing something about the flooding because it costs them a lot of money each time. So that's where you then suddenly see rain gardens and biospheres popping up. It's not only that they pop up, sometimes it also goes in a counterproductive direction where people decide, you know, we need to have bigger catch basins, bigger storm sewers to get rid of the water faster. That sort of works too, but only for you. It doesn't work for the guy on the other end of the pipe, because now he gets all the water on his property and all the water that you sent off.
Oh, lovely. Double trouble.
Exactly. But that, you know, unfortunately, if you look around, this is how we treat stormwater these days. If I go a little bit technical here, when we manage stormwater, what we're really trying to do is hold on to all the water in detention basins, and we store that temporarily, and then we try to let it go slowly. We let it go slowly from the detention basin. What we don't do is reduce the volume of stormwater. Like the volume of stormwater that comes into the detention basin is usually the same volume of stormwater that comes out of the detention basin. What we should do instead is reduce that volume, and that you can do through infiltration. So in this case, you have water arriving in a retention basin, and you let it allow to infiltrate, so what actually comes out at the end is significantly less compared to what went in.
What can homeowners do who are listening to this show today? What can they do? What are some small steps that people can take? Because I think, obviously, nobody's going to dig up their yard and build a retention system, although maybe that's a good idea for some. But, you know, when you're in a garden and you're facing a situation where you still want it to be beautiful, but you need to manage water usage, give us a couple of things that they can do.
I think a retention system like a rain garden or a bioswale is definitely very high on the options because it's very economical to do, and it can be very beautiful indeed. What I would definitely put on the chopping block first is your turf grass. Turf grass has sort of become the default landscape solution because that's what we know best. We know how to take care of it. It's easy, but also a really big problem. But how much turf do you really need on your property? If you have kids, you want to have a patch of turf so they can throw the ball around and all that stuff, so you can barbecue. Sure, you keep that. But then all the other turf beyond that, do you really need that? So this is how you can start thinking about what's on your property and how can you reduce impervious surfaces. If you have a really big driveway, does it need to be that big? Can it be smaller so you have less impervious area? Or can you convert from impervious pavement like asphalt or concrete to a pervious pavement system that actually allows rainwater to infiltrate through the pavement into the ground? If you have a really big roof, if you're in an urban area, for instance, does it need to be a conventional roof? Or can you install a green roof which also absorbs rainwater and then evaporates the absorbed rainwater back into the atmosphere? So there are a number of things you can do, and I saw basically went from the low-cost solutions, which are the retention systems like the rain garden and bioswale, to sort of the high-cost solution, which would be like the green roof. Green roofs are usually very expensive.
When we come back, Marcus, could you give me and give all of us listening just a couple of places that we can go online so that we can actually see what some of these different solutions look like? And, of course, we'll post it all at thinklink.com. Will you stay with us for a moment?
Sure, I will.
All right. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We're going to talk a little bit more with Marcus de la Fleur about sustainable landscape architecture next on The Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Klink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to The Elise Klink Show. It's Easter Sunday. We're talking about green building because on Tuesday, it's Earth Day. And happy birthday to the Earth. And I thought it would be nice to hear some of what today's leading thinkers are thinking about when it comes to sustainable design. Marcus de la Fleur is with us now. He's a sustainable landscape architect. And you can find him on the web at De La Fleur, D-E-L-A-F-L-E-U-R, of the flower, which is such a wonderful name for what you do, .com. Your mother named you well, I guess.
She did indeed.
So, Marcus, when I asked just before the break, I asked you for a couple of places that we could look online, because I think it's hard to imagine what sustainable landscape looks like. A lot of people picture a lot of rocks and, you know, Arizona. But here we are in Atlanta or in the Midwest. Where can we go to look at pictures?
It sort of sounds shamelessly a self-promotion here, but I have a beautiful pilot project in Amherst, Illinois, where one of my previous residents, where we have executed a lot of the technologies we just talked about, green roof, rain barrels, porous pavement, rain gardens, bioswales, you name it. And really the whole purpose was with the webpage to demonstrate what you can do in a residential landscape to treat rainwater responsible. So it's a wonderful resource, and I would direct people to that 168M.
Then that's
pilot project.
So we will. You've got information. I'm looking at your website right now. It's delafleur.com. We'll link to it from my website, and everybody can go there and take a look. Marcus, thank you so much for being with me today.
Hey, you're very welcome.
I appreciate it. I'm Elise Flink. Unfortunately, time is up. Happy Easter, everybody. I hope you find all the eggs. It's awful when you find them like a week later. Earth Day is Tuesday. Go out and celebrate. Be one with the Earth. I'll be back next Sunday with another edition of the Elise Flink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.